When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Good evening, everyone. We begin the readout tonight with day two of the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Testimony wrapped a short time ago, and it was incredibly emotional all day long. The jury heard hours of testimony from several eyewitnesses who watched George Floyd die under Chauvin's knee. Four of the witnesses were minors at the time of the killing, and two of them still are, so we only heard their voices, but they remained off camera. The youngest, just 9 years old. Another of the witnesses, Darnella Frazier, was 17 when she recorded the infamous video of Floyd's death that went viral and set off the chain of events leading to this trial and yet another global outcry for racial justice. Here is part of her emotional testimony today.
I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe, please get off of me. I can't breathe." He cried for his mom. He was in pain. It seemed like he knew. It seemed like he knew it was over for him. He was terrified. This was a cry for help. When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad. I look at my brothers. I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father. I have a black brother. I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them.
Well, it didn't appear that any of today's testimony moved Chauvin, who was in the courtroom. But witness after witness broke down on the stand, wishing they had been able to do more for George Floyd.
Melissa, why is this difficult for you to talk about?
It was difficult because I felt like there wasn't really anything I could do as a bystander. The highest power was there, and I felt like I was feeling it.
Genevieve Hansen, a Minneapolis firefighter, was also on the scene and testified that she pleaded to let her help Mr. Floyd, but was pushed away by one of the police officers.
He said something along the lines of, "If you really are a Minneapolis firefighter, you would know better than to get involved." That's not right. I mean, that's exactly what I should have done. There was no medical assistance on scene, and I got there and I could have given medical assistance. That's exactly what I should have done.
The day began with Donald Williams concluding his testimony that began yesterday. The mixed martial arts fighter fought back tears when the court played the 911 call he made. Williams described exactly why he felt the need to make that call, even with police already present.
At some point, did you make a 911 call?
That is correct. I did call the police on the police.
Right. And why did you do that?
Because I believe I witnessed a murder.
Now, there were police there, right?
There were police there.
Okay. Why didn't you just talk to them about it?
I believe that we just didn't have no connection. You know, I spoke to them, but not on a connection of a human being relationship.
With me now is Katie Fang, MSNBC legal contributor, and Mark Claxton, retired NYPD detective and director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. And Mark, I want to go to you first. Let me first play that 911 call that we were just talking about. And this is Donald Williams, who, again, he's a mixed martial arts fighter. He's a wrestler. He's got a lot of experience in sort of the physical handling, one person or another, in sports. But here is his 911 call, calling the police on the police.
He just pretty much just killed this guy that wasn't resisting arrest. He had his knee on the dude's neck the whole time, Officer 987. The man went, stopped breathing. He wasn't resisting arrest or nothing. He was already in handcuffs. That was bogus what they just did to this man. He was unresponsive. He wasn't resisting arrest or any of it. And I'm sitting here talking to another off-duty firefighter that just sat here and watched it in front of us as well. Okay. And she told them to check the man's pulse, but they wouldn't even check the pulse.
And there was a lot of testimony to try to make Donald Williams, Mark, look like he was somehow threatening to the officers, that he was hostile. And he said, you're not going to make me look angry. He was angry, as were everyone there, watching somebody die in front of them. But the other thing that I want to play for you really quickly before I get your comment, Mark, is he also talked about having a conversation with Officer Tao, who's one of the other officers who was there, and the hostile reaction that he got. Let's play a little bit of the video that was shown in court today about the bystanders and how they were treated.
Bro, he was just moving when I walked up.
So y'all are going to wait for the ambulance to have a pulse?
I've been watching this whole time.
I'm busy trying to deal with you guys
right
now.
Okay, today,
bro,
there's three of you guys. You guys should be able to multitask. That's your job, right?
As a former police officer, can you just comment about this, Mark? Because, you know, the other officers, including Officer Tao, seemed more hostile to the crowd who were outraged at what Derek Chauvin was doing than they seemed concerned about the man on the ground who they were claiming was a threat.
There are two things over the past couple of days that really jump out at me. And that is that a lot of the attributes that people, or at least police worshipers, that I'll call the police worshipers, will attribute to police officers, such as courage, compassion, empathy, integrity, and humanity, were only displayed by the non-police civilians on the scene. The police officers showed none of those characteristics throughout the entire interaction, and that led to the death of Mr. Floyd. And what that is the manifestation of something we've talked about before, that toxic police culture. It was only the civilians that were acting as if they were professional, trained police officers. And point two is, we got an opportunity to see something I think that we took for granted or didn't realize. And that is that there are other victims of this killing. Those individuals, those brave men and women who witnessed, who were demanding, who were begging and pleading, even feeling guilty about not taking the next step, a physical interaction, intervening physically. Those brave men and women are victims, mm-hmm. and they don't have the opportunity to receive justice, if you will, in this particular case. Hopefully, Mr. Floyd will and his family will.
Yeah, let's play Darnella Frazier. Darnella Frazier, her testimony was some of the most moving testimony. The kids, the underage people who testified were really moving. Here's Darnella Frazier, who actually shot that now infamous video, the 8-minute and 46-second video, which we now know was like 9 minutes and 20 seconds. Here she is being taking questioning about whether or not he was whether or not George Floyd was offered care.
So as you were observing Mr. Floyd under the knee of Mr. Chauvin, did you ever see Mr. Chauvin do anything to offer care to Mr. Floyd?
No.
Did he ever either let up or get up so that he could breathe?
No.
Did you ever see him try to administer CPR?
No.
Did you see him call anyone else to administer aid to Mr. Floyd?
No.
Katie, we talked yesterday about the sort of most dangerous thing for the defense here is that after there was no pulse and after Chauvin was told there was no pulse, he still stayed on top of George Floyd and continued to constrict his breathing. That testimony, what do you make of what you heard today?
Well, it ties in to what we heard in the opening statement from the prosecution, the idea that a police officer has a duty to protect, but also to show compassion. As you'll recall, during the opening statement by the prosecution, we heard the mission statement of the Minnesota Police Department that includes the idea of having this duty to care for the citizens. But you know what's important from a legal perspective, Joy, is that there's a third-degree murder charge that got reinstated. And that has a lower standard of proof than the second degree unintentional murder and the second degree manslaughter charges that Derek Chauvin is facing. To prove the third degree murder, all the state has to prove is that Derek Chauvin caused the death of George Floyd through an act that is imminently dangerous to others. So what did we hear today? We heard lay people, eyewitnesses saying it was dangerous. He couldn't breathe. He didn't get off of him. He didn't give him help. And then we had firefighter EMT Genevieve Hansen saying, in her professional opinion, it was dangerous. He didn't get off of him. We heard two different people today say that they called the cops on the cops. And George Floyd may not have been able to testify on his behalf because he is gone. But we heard his voice today through the videos, which was eminently powerful. And we also heard it through the voices of those kids that testified. And it was so compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's play Genevieve Hansen, because I thought her testimony was really good, too. She got into a little mix up with the judge at the end, but she was quite good. And this is Genevieve Hansen testifying today.
Do you think it would make your job fighting the fire harder if someone started yelling at you and telling you that you were doing it wrong?
I'm very confident in the training that I've been given, so I would not be concerned about somebody that was not trained to the extent I have been.
What if they started calling you names?
Like I said, I know my job, and I would be confident in doing my job, and there's nothing anybody could say that would distract me.
Mark, this struck me as one of the weirdest defenses here, that the people standing there were distracting the officers from providing care to Mr. Floyd. They didn't show any. There were three officers holding down George Floyd. There was only one officer trying to control the scene, Officer Tao. So if they were so concerned about the crowd, why was it 3-1 on Mr. Floyd and not 3-1 on the crowd? Now, that to me didn't make sense. Did it make sense to you?
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Didn't make sense to me at all, but it's a defense, just throwing everything up against the wall, seeing what sticks. What it did display was that not only didn't the police officers live up to their duty to care for Mr. Floyd, they rejected the offer of assistance by a person who claims to be a professional healthcare person. So they are just tripling down on their negligence in this particular case, and it will really come out later on about their liability in regards to the death of Mr. Floyd. It's clear, as both sides have said, primarily the prosecutors have said, the video speaks for itself.
You know, and Katie, you know, it is very difficult to, I will say again, it is really hard to convict police officers, even when it seems like obvious that what they've done is wrong. We just had a case just this week where officers were acquitted for beating up another officer who was undercover. He was covering and videotaping at a Black Lives Matter protest. The other officers beat him to the point where he needed surgery, and they still didn't get convicted. So it's very hard. But from what you saw today, I've never seen a case like this with this much compelling evidence from young people, from a firefighter, a professional, that was so damning. I've never seen anything like it. To you, does this seem like a sort of separate sui generis case against Mr. Chauvin?
Well, listen, we have to strap in for a long ride. This is just day two. There's going to be a lot more witnesses. And the reason why we heard the defense focus on the crowd collectively is because they could not go after the individual witnesses today. They were minors. They were women. They were breaking down. I mean, you couldn't do that. So what you do is you go after the collective crowd. But remember, in the opening statements for Chauvin's defense, they said, let's not make an emotional decision. Right? Let's not make it an emotional decision. Let's listen to the actual evidence. And what they're going to say is they're going to wait for their day in the sun, which is going to be the medical testimony, the expert testimony from that, and the no excessive use of force. They're going to try to tell the jury, which they've already done, we need you to make a decision based on common sense, logic, and reason. That's the only thing they can do, because it is inescapable. The emotional component today was harsh. It was really hard. It was brutal to have to sit through and hear it and listen to it.
Especially with all of replaying the video as people were narrating what they saw that day. It was something else. Katie Fang, Mark Claxton, thank you both very much for your expertise. And up next on The Readout, you will not believe the explanation from a Georgia state trooper for why he arrested a Black lawmaker at the state capitol last week. Meanwhile, Georgia is going all Jim Crow, while another state is making it easier for people to vote. Imagine that. Plus, the New York Times is reporting tonight that one of Trump's biggest allies in Congress, his little buddy, Matt Gaetz, is under investigation for possibly violating federal sex trafficking laws stemming from an alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl. He denies it. And here's a runner-up for tonight's absolute worst, if that wasn't it. Baylor women's basketball coach Kim Mulkey, who says the NCAA needs to, quote, dump the COVID testing. Wouldn't it be a shame, she said, if a players test positive and don't get to play in the Final Four, so they can make other people sick? Kim Mulkey, that's a really bad idea, ma'am. But you are not tonight's absolute worst. The big reveal is coming up. The readout continues after this. As states across the country race to enact laws to suppress voting, New Jersey did the opposite today. Governor Phil Murphy, joined on video by Stacey Abrams, signed into law a bill expanding early voting, allowing in-person voting up to 10 days before an election. It stands in stark contrast to Georgia's Jim Crow voter suppression law, which faces mounting legal challenges. Today, a third lawsuit was filed by the ACLU on behalf of several groups representing Black and brown voters. Meanwhile, calls for an economic boycott of major Georgia-based corporations, Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines, continue to grow. Also today, we learned the most ludicrous explanation for the arrest of one protester of Georgia's law. Georgia State Representative Park Cannon forcibly hauled out by state troopers after knocking on Governor Brian Kemp's door while he signed the bill. Well, in an incident report, the officer who arrested Cannon said, "I felt that if I did not take action, the other protesters would have been emboldened to commit similar acts. The events of January 6th at the U.S. Capitol were in the back of my mind." I can't believe I have to say this. But a lone African-American state representative gently knocking on the governor's door while he signed a law stripping the rights of the state's Black and brown citizens behind closed doors is in no way, shape, or form comparable to violent insurrectionists laying siege to the United States Capitol to repudiate our democracy because Black and brown voters chose their preferred candidate and the insurrectionists didn't like the outcome. Full stop. Today, Stacey Abrams applauded New Jersey's new law, in contrast with her home state, as taking the country in the right direction toward democracy. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy joins me now. Let's talk about this new law. You know, it's interesting that sort of New York and New Jersey were not like really at the front edge of really expansive voter access in terms of lots of early voting and things like that. So this is a big change.
Huge change, Joy. Great to be with you. We've made a lot of changes since we got into office 3 years ago. This is a big one. In-person, early voting. By the way, no restriction if someone wants to hand you some water while you're in line. That's something also we're proud of up here in New Jersey. But it's a big step forward. Stacey was with us. It was a really special, viral, but really special moment.
Did you have any pushback from Republicans? Because they seem to think that things like what you've done, making it easier to vote, is somehow magically going to produce up to now non-existent voter fraud. Have you gotten any pushback from Republicans?
Yeah. Yes, to some extent. They're cloaking their opposition largely, and you're not giving us enough time or putting enough money in this. And it is a big step for our county clerks and local voting officials, but we'll work with them, and we're confident we have enough time and we have enough money in this. Yeah, you know this, Joy, the chances of getting hit by lightning, I think this is literally the case, are higher than uncovering voter fraud. So the entire thing is a myth, which makes the Georgia situation even more tragic.
Would it help a state like New Jersey, which has done now expansion of the access to voting, to have a federal law like S1, the For the People Act? Would it help your state?
Listen, I think something that is a consistent law across all of our states is something we'd support. Obviously, the devil's in the details in terms of what's in that law, but we're proud to have automatic voter registration. Folks on parole or probation now have the right to vote in New Jersey. Now we've got in-person early voting. We want to take some more steps. As long as it didn't undermine the steps that we've either taken or want to take, absolutely.
Let me turn to another topic while I have you here. New Jersey is having a challenge in terms of COVID. Very high per capita rate. The curve is going the wrong direction. What's going on there?
Yeah, it is going in the wrong direction. Listen, we are the densest state in America, Joy, and we're in the densest region in America, and we're a northern cold weather state. So you combine doing a lot of our stuff indoors with density, which is usually our friend, but not in a pandemic. It's a little similar to what we saw last spring. The numbers are not nearly as bad as last spring, and our vaccination rollout is going quite well relative to any expectation, but we're up against it with these variants. We've got South African, UK, Brazilian, New York City, and we're challenging. We're going to get through it. There's no question about it. But our numbers have gone a little sideways.
All right. Well, hopefully things will get better. Governor Phil Murphy, thank you for taking some time to be with us this evening. Really appreciate you. And congrats on the voting bill. All right. Joining me now is Bishop Reginald Jackson, presiding prelate of the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Georgia. And let's go right into this, Bishop Jackson. There is now a third lawsuit against the law in your home state that's been filed by the ACLU, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, on behalf of the 6th District AME Church, other plaintiffs, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, the Georgia Muslim Voter Project, Women Watch Africa, and the Latino Community Fund Georgia. How hopeful are you? You know, the federal judge system is now sort of fraught with lots of Trumpism. Are you hopeful that this law will get overturned?
I'm going to remain hopeful. And let me simply say, I think this is going to end up going to the Supreme Court. And the nation's going to find out what kind of Supreme Court we have. This would give the Supreme Court a chance to clean up the mess that it created in Shelby versus Holder. And we're going to see what kind of Supreme Court we have in this country.
And one of the people voting on that will be Georgia native, Pinport, Georgia native Clarence Thomas, who I don't think supports the Voting Rights Act last time I checked. But we'll see what happens.
Stay positive, Joy.
We'll try to stay positive. Tyler Perry, who's somebody who I've been wondering whether he was going to say something. He's got this 230-acre magnificent facility for making movies. And lots of people are making film and TV down there. He's now spoken out against the law. This is what he said. He said, "I'm resting my hope in the DOJ taking a hard look at this unconstitutional voter suppression law that harkens to the Jim Crow era. And some consider boycotting. Please remember that we did turn Georgia blue and there's a gubernatorial race on the horizon. There's beauty. Oh, that's the beauty of a democracy." He noted he's been down this road before with the previous LGBT, anti-LGBT laws and anti-abortion bills. A boycott. What do you make of that as somebody who's in a leadership position in Georgia? Do you think that either the state or these companies should be boycotted?
Well, Joy, in fact, on Thursday at 12 o'clock in front of Coca-Cola, we're going to announce the beginning of a boycott on next Monday. Let me say, I'm supportive of boycotting the corporations. I'm not advocating the movie theaters. I'm not advocating Major League Baseball. I think that will take care of itself. I think we need to concentrate on these corporations who blacks give their dollars to. And we give our dollars to them. We expect them to stand with us.
And Coca-Cola put out a statement on Monday saying we're disappointed with the outcome. They sort of tried to revise their previous statement. We don't see this as a final chapter. We'll also continue to press for improvements to Georgia's election laws in future sessions. I'm not sure what they think is going to happen. It's a 98-page bill. Delta, they stood by their statement in which they said the law was improved over time. When it comes to boycotts, Andrew Young, the great Andrew Young, has made a point. We're saying that he pointed out that, you know, the economy in Georgia is larger than the economy in South Africa, which, of course, was subject to pretty significant boycotts. We're the 44th economy in the world. And he says, you can quote me. I don't know why anybody wants to F with that. He put it that way very colorfully. But what impact do you think a boycott of Coca-Cola, Delta, UPS, Aflac, et cetera, would have?
Well, let me say this first of all. Let's take Coca-Cola. In June of last year, James Quincy, the chairman, CEO of Coca-Cola, said our companies can do better. We must stand with Black Lives Matter movement as allies and support other social justice causes. Our companies can do better. Well, here's a chance for them to do better, and they flunked it. Let's take Delta Airlines. Delta Airlines sent out an in-house memo where they actually praised the passage of this bill. And these statements released today or yesterday, they only seek to give cover to the fact that they have failed the Black and brown community by supporting our quest not to have our vote suppressed. And I don't think we can let that go unchallenged. We cannot act as if that's okay, we'll do better next time.
And are they the only companies that are going to face this? Because as I mentioned, there are lots of companies. There's UPS, there's Aflac. Can we expect these boycott calls to grow beyond Delta and Coca-Cola?
Yes, I think there are. In fact, we're trying to arrange a virtual meeting with corporate executives across the country, because this is not just a Georgia problem. Including Iowa and Georgia, there are 41 other states which have bills similar to these on the books. This is really a threat to our democracy, number one. And number two, we need to call it what it is. It's racist. If Republicans had won, these bills would not have been introduced. When these laws worked for them, which in fact they passed before, when they worked for them, they were fine. When they worked for us, all of a sudden, there's something wrong with them. And the most ludicrous thing is, all this legislation is based on a lie told by the former liar in chief. And now all of a sudden, we want to give credibility to a lie. I remind Georgia, 2018, the former Secretary of State, now the governor, he took 500,000 names off the voter rolls, many of them voters of color. There was no legislation. There was no concern about the outrage of blacks. Everything was fine. But now when they lose, all of a sudden, there's no integrity, and we have to do something about it. That is absolute foolishness.
Very succinctly said, Bishop Reginald Jackson. We will keep up with this. Thank you very much, sir. Really appreciate your time tonight. And still ahead, President Biden announces his first judicial nominees, including one who could become the first woman of color on America's highest court. It's a diverse slate of nominees, and we will tell you all about them next.
I'm looking forward to making sure there's a black woman on the Supreme Court to make sure we, in fact, get every representation. Not a joke.
That was candidate Joe Biden promising to nominate an African-American woman to the highest court in the land. This morning, he took a major step toward keeping that promise. He nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson for the influential U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, a seat left vacant by Attorney General Merrick Garland. The move cements Jackson's frontrunner status for the Supreme Court if a vacancy opens up. Judge Jackson was one of 11 nominations sent to the Senate this morning by President Biden. The new judges, if confirmed, include three African-American women for appeals court vacancies, the first Muslim federal judge, and the first Asian-American woman to serve on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Biden's picks stand in stark contrast to the slew of barely qualified white male ideologue judges that Donald Trump and his Senate henchman Mitch McConnell rammed through at an astonishing rate. Administration officials told reporters to expect a steady drumbeat of nominations to fill roughly 70 vacancies. Joining me now is Neil Katyal, former acting solicitor general. This is exciting, Neil, because, you know, one of the sort of signature things that Donald Trump did is he was very proud. He got like more than 200 federal judges put in place and got, you know, three Supreme Court justices. Now it's Biden's turn. What do you make of the fact that he's being very deliberate about making sure that those nominations have this rich diversity?
Joy, it is a historic and awesome and very happy day for the federal judiciary. It is no secret that I was pretty upset for the first 18 months of the Obama administration because they didn't focus on judges and particularly didn't focus on Court of Appeals judges. And Biden is, and in a huge way. I mean, this is a brilliant, committed, diverse slate that was nominated today. And this list really disproves the conservative fantasy that diversity and inclusiveness come at the cost of competence. Yes, these nominees are historically diverse. They're also some of the most qualified nominees we've seen in years. I mean, Trump didn't nominate, you just put a chart up, but one important statistic's not on that chart. Trump didn't nominate a single black judge to the appeals court, not one. You have to go back to Nixon to find a president who did that. And Biden just nominated three, all of whom are women. And no president has confirmed more than three black women or four or even 8 years. Biden did this in one day.
Yeah.
Some differences speak for themselves. It's a big day.
Well, and, you know, Donald Trump was very deliberate about making sure that plum positions went to white men. Like, he was making a statement, I think, more than anything else. So there's two pieces to this. So the one part is the Stephen Breyer part, which is a bit uncomfortable. You know, this kind of happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg as well. and the idea that, you know, you don't want to chase someone into retirement before they're ready. It isn't fair, right? But there's also sort of a gerontocracy kind of in our system that you think, well, you know, he doesn't want to wait until, let's say, Democrats lose control of the Senate. You know, they're one Senate vacancy away from losing control of the Senate. So there's that Ruth Bader Ginsburg issue. What do you make of that debate regarding Mr. Breyer?
Well, first of all, I had the privilege of being Justice Breyer's law clerk, and I do think he's one of the greatest jurists to have served our country. He's careful. He's moderate. He's about just trying to make the system work for all Americans. And so I guess I find this conversation a little distasteful that's playing out in the newspaper op-eds and the like. I mean, Justice Breyer is an incredibly public-minded person. I don't think these articles are going to matter one bit. And, you know, he'll decide when he wants to. But I think, Joy, the important point is actually let's not think about the Supreme Court right now. We'll eventually get there. But let's think about the circuit courts, because that's where Trump did so much damage and where history has done damage. Well, we've never had a Native American nominee to the circuit courts ever in our history. And, you know, there are fabulous ones. I work with one, Hillary Tompkins. I worked with her when she was at the Interior Department, you know, and there are others, too. But I think the point is that, you know, Biden is doing exactly the right thing today, and he's going to continue to do it, which is diversify the judiciary and don't just think about the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these nominees. I happen to know Ketanji Brown Jackson. I knew her as Ketanji Brown when we were in college. So I think she's wonderful. And she actually made it to the top three. It was her, Merrick Garland, and Sri Srivanisan. They were the like top three choices for the SCOTUS, and President Obama chose Garland. So there were a lot of people who were disappointed. I will say I was one of them. And then all of this drama played out with Merrick Garland being just completely sort of humiliated by Mitch McConnell, and just not even, they wouldn't even meet with him, wouldn't talk with him. Well, now look at karma. He's now Attorney General, and that opens the door for Ketanji Brown. She is the person most thought of as being next up for a SCOTUS seat. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so I think, look, any of those three would have been great jurists, and Ketanji would be a great Supreme Court justice. She is brilliant. She's got a deep soul. She's a great writer. She's collegial. She's not a bomb thrower. She's going to fit in incredibly well on this new court, the D.C. Circuit, our nation's second highest court. I also think there are other people, too, in that league. And so I don't think we should write them off. Like, yeah, you know, Leandra Kruger, who's a justice on the California Supreme Court, who's about the best lawyer I've ever worked with. And, you know, so there's other people, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think what the president did here is say, here's a great person for our nation's second highest court. She should go up today. And along with this other just rich, diverse, competent slate of nominees, I mean, this is just a really incredible day.
I'm just looking at some of these folks. And I mean, the idea of somebody like her plus Sonia Sotomayor, that just instantly changes just the way the court would look, right? Two women of color on it. There are a lot of other great people. There are people, there is, as you said, Tiffany Cunningham, who's a nominee for the U.S. Court of Appeals. There's Kansas Jackson Akiwumi, nominee for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Like, you could just go down. There are lots of these judges who are of different, you know, sort of backgrounds and religions. In your view, what difference does that make to jurisprudence if you have more diversity, in your view?
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Well, I don't know that that just race alone does, but life experience does. And here you've got, I think, people who've lived all different walks of life. A Muslim American, our very first Muslim American judge, should he be confirmed, is going to probably have a different set of experiences than, you know, a lot of the Trump nominees, to put it mildly. You've got incredible, you know, the Seventh Circuit judge, Candace Jackson Akiwumi, is, a federal public defender, spent the last 10 years doing that. That's a rare voice. You know, I have the privilege of arguing in the circuit courts all the time. Very few judges have that kind of experience. And so by doing that, you really bolster the tapestry of what jurisprudence is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And breaking the sort of Heritage Foundation, like everyone is sort of cut from that same cloth and you just get them rolled out over and over. You're right. You get sort of one view on the court. It could be a great thing happening. Joe Biden's doing. Neil Katyal, always great talking with you. Thank you. And still ahead, the White House announces new initiatives aimed at addressing the recent surge in anti-Asian violence. And what's really behind the phony right-wing freakout over Lil Nas X and transgendered kids playing sports? The answer is tonight's absolute worst. Who run the world? Well, obviously, Lil Nas X. Duh. This week, he broke Twitter again, plus the internet and right-wing brains with his new video, Montero, Call Me By Your Name, in which he perfects certain pole dance moves, including one of which he's like upside down. Impressive. And also twerks on the devil before killing him. Natch. The song, which is a bop, is an obvious and artistic play on the conservative Christian idea that people who are gay will go to hell, which Nas does literally in the video. And he amplified the meme by releasing these Satan-themed custom sneakers, 666 of them, which sold out in less than a minute. The right-wing outrage was entirely predictable and proof that Lil Nas X knows his enemies better than they know him. Tweeting, y'all love saying we going to hell, but get upset when I actually go there. It comes at a time when the right has lost the culture wars decisively, like a generation ago, including among their own kids. Fixating now on a new boogeyman. Well, a boogie kid, meaning trans youth. Republican legislators in more than two dozen states are pushing through bills that take the 2016 bathroom bill to a new level. The measures would prevent trans kids from playing K through 12 sports, deny gender-affirming care for trans minors, or create religious exemptions that could deny LGBTQ people medical treatment at all if medical providers or pharmacists voice a religious objection. But like the Republican freakout over wokeness or how they frame the Democrats' voter convenience bill as literally demonic, or like flip out over Lil Nas X or Megan Thee Stallion videos, which they're watching repeatedly clearly, it's all fake outrage. According to one recent Gallup poll, 0.6% of the American adult population is transgender. But we don't actually know the real number for a host of reasons. Still, that is a tiny community of fellow human beings. Certainly not enough for an alleged takeover of girls' sports by trans youth. If these right-wingers cared so much about girls' sports, then why aren't they advocating for women athletes to get equal pay and decent gym facilities that match what the men have? So if the outrage isn't real, which it isn't, what is it really about? The usual political power. It's the same reason Crocodile Cruz and his jungle safari friends are beclowning themselves at the border. It's purely performative, an effort to inspire their dejected Trumpy voters to stick with the program by promising to hurt the people they fear, just the way Trump did. Polling shows that in the wake of their golden calf's defeat in November and Democratic victories in Georgia, one in five Republicans report being less motivated to vote in future elections versus just 5% of Democrats, which explains why the Republicans are advancing draconian voter suppression laws designed to make it harder for their opposition to vote. Because in order to keep their base engaged, they have to essentially promise conservative voters that they will win, even if it means by cheating. The same goes with anti-trans laws and the border freakout. The culture wars are not about culture. They're about keeping right-wing Christians engaged and voting Republican. And what better than a fake stolen election or racializing the coronavirus or losing your marbles over a handful of trans junior high school softball players to help you avoid revealing that your party actually has no ideas that people would want to vote for? And if this was just like consequence-free performative nonsense, it would just be dumb. But it's not consequence-free. Demonizing China over COVID has produced actual violence against Asian people. Demonizing trans kids gets them actually bullied and harassed. Demonizing immigrants makes it politically impossible to pass common sense laws to solve a generations-long issue. I could go on, but here's the bottom line. Useless drama. It does have consequences, sometimes violent consequences, and it is the absolute worst. And when we come back, we're going to talk about those very real consequences for our fellow Americans. Attacks against Asian Americans have reached a crisis point. The latest incident to go viral involving, once again, an elderly woman. A warning to our viewers, the video that we're about to show you is very disturbing. Okay. This surveillance video released by the NYPD shows a man kicking a 65-year-old Asian woman to the ground in broad daylight in New York City while hurling anti-Asian remarks. Police are calling it a targeted hate crime and are searching for the suspect. Much of the public's outrage is also directed at the building staff that you see here, who stood by and did absolutely nothing. One person even closed the door on the victim. Those staff members have been suspended. This comes on a day when President Biden announced new initiatives to counter the violence, including a task force to address coronavirus-fueled xenophobia against Asian Americans. And joining me now is Kurt Bardella, former House Oversight Committee spokesman. And Kurt, you and I have talked about this a lot. You've talked about it a lot on MSNBC, and you've written articles about it. It is impossible to ignore that we've had one whole year of the previous president naming the coronavirus the China virus, and even worse terms than that. Do you connect that to what we're seeing in this upsurge in violence?
Yeah, Joy, this is a situation where the numbers don't lie. Since March of 2020, there have been more than 3,700 hate crimes against Asian Americans in this country. We have seen 150% increase in hate crimes against the AAPI community. We're seeing violence and mayhem targeted in the most disgusting, unimaginable ways happening just in front of businesses, on public streets, riding public transit. And it's only escalating and getting worse. We saw just the other week in a congressional hearing about hate crimes against Asian Americans, the Republican Party, the very Republican Party responsible for almost giving permission and allowing people to perpetrate these type of crimes against Asian Americans, we saw them make light of it. We saw Congressman Chip Roy use a lynching reference at a hate crime hearing. This is all cause and effect. And the data that keeps coming out keeps telling the same story. Republican rhetoric was out there putting back targets on the backs of Asian Americans. Crimes and hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans keeps going up.
And we have data now. Richard Louie was on. He's got a great new book out. And he was talking about data that was going to come out about AAPI people and violence. And it's now been released today. And the question is, have you ever been a victim of a hate crime, verbal or physical abuse to property caused by race or ethnicity? 27% of Asian Americans report yes. 24% of Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. 22% is the national average. AAPI women report 55% of AAPI women have experienced specific incidences of racism in the past 2 years, such as being called a racial slur. So we're now seeing that there's quantifiable data. And some of these surveys, I should note, were conducted both in English and also in Korean and in Chinese, which is new for polling. So thank God we're finally getting some updates. But what do we do to turn it back, to turn this back?
Well, I think we're seeing some of these right steps happen now, like just the idea of being able to get the right data and being able to reach out to the AAPI community in the language that they speak. We're seeing with the initiative today that the president announced a real concerted effort to expand investment in data about hate crimes and violence, using more resources to help fund different initiatives that affect the AAPI community. $49.5 million in funding to help AAPI victims of domestic violence and assault. The COVID Equity Task Force being launched. More coordination between the entire federal government, from HHS to DOJ. A real concerted effort to look at the role of law enforcement. There's a reason why so many hate crimes go unreported.
Yeah. And I think there's a connection here, an intersectional connection, because we've seen that this happened to the LGBTQ community, where you've had hate crimes that are associated with the attitudes people have. You know, this whole thing about trans kids, it's going to produce more bullying and more hate and more, you know, terror for young trans kids. It's like people don't understand there is a direct relationship, which is why I love what Lil Nas X is doing. Sorry, but he's basically saying we're going to push back because we have cultural agency, and we just don't have to sit there and take it, even in hip hop, which is not an easy place to be LGBTQ. Let's talk a little bit about some of the breaking news while I have you just for a moment. This is a hard turn, but there is this Matt Gaetz news tonight. I got to ask you about it. What are your thoughts? He's denying it. He is saying that this is a plot against him by a DOJ official. He's been one of the people that's been one of the big culture warriors for Donald Trump. He's out there very loud and proud doing that. And now he finds himself in this position being investigated over alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old. Your thoughts?
Well, how shocking is it that the party that, funded and supported Roy Moore in Alabama is a party that's produced a Matt Gaetz? You know, the idea that Matt Gaetz can be allowed to sit on the House Judiciary Committee, which has oversight over the Justice Department, as this investigation is being conducted is ridiculous. He needs to recuse himself. The Republican leadership needs to remove him from the committee until this is resolved. And I think it's important to point out that this is an investigation that began under the previous occupant of the Justice Department, Attorney General Bill Barr. This isn't partisan. This isn't a Democrat versus Republican situation. This is an investigation that began last year. It's now become public, and Matt Gaetz has a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah, under Bill, under William Barr. Here's Michael Schmidt, the reporter who broke the story from the New York Times earlier.
They're investigating whether he had a sexual relationship with him, whether he paid for her to travel, interstate travel. Now, that being that the girl was under 18, and that Gaetz was, you know, they're investigating whether Gaetz was sleeping, was, you know, had a relationship with her. That raises a host of legal questions about whether Gaetz broke the law.
Just as a political matter, Kurt, he is claiming that this is a plot by a former DOJ official to bribe him. That's what he's claiming in a Twitter storm. But as you said, this was an investigation that, started under Bill Barr, Bill Barr's Justice Department. Could this be the breaking point between Gaetz world and Trump world? Because this is the Trump DOJ he's talking about.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that we've seen when it comes to anything related to Donald Trump is there's no low that's too low for him to still associate with you, particularly when it comes to issues of potential sexual harassment and inappropriate conduct. Donald Trump is himself a long history of sexual harassment and inappropriate conduct. So it seems like in today's Donald Trump Republican-led world, things like this somehow get you promoted within the Republican Party. We'll see what ultimately the facts are. But Matt Gaetz is already out there doing his best Trump impression, trying to make this something that it isn't. And we'll see what ends up coming out about it in the long run.
Matt Gaetz still out there making Florida proud. Kurt Bardella, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here tonight. That is tonight's readout.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.